Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll look into a big issue that was not mentioned in the recent presidential campaign, the Afghan War, a protracted engagement war-weary Americans want to forget, that has had 11 commanders in the last 11 years of America's longest war. One of the leading experts on Afghanistan and its people and culture, Thomas Barfield, joins us. He is the president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and the author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. And we will discuss the future of this tormented country the U.S. is withdrawing from in 2014. Then we will further explore Afghanistan's uncertain future with Christine Fair. She was a United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and is a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We will discuss the likely aftermath of the U.S. and NATO withdrawal from Afghanistan and whether a reduced American footprint in the region will diminish the virulent anti-Americanism in a nuclear-armed and increasingly unstable Pakistan. And joining us now is Thomas Barfield, who is a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Barfield.
Thank you.
And here we are with our 11th commander in Afghanistan in 11 years. And the outgoing commander, of course, is in trouble because of this sexual soap opera involving General Petraeus and a couple of women, which, you know, is a it's something new to me, the idea that there are military groupies. I've heard of groupies following rock stars, but apparently there's a group of women that find men with medals attractive. What's your sense, though, of what Obama's trying to do here? Because my impression is that he reluctantly, in fact, he probably got strong-armed by Petraeus into the surge, and he's clearly trying to get out of there. Do you think this withdrawal is going to proceed?
Well, the withdrawal will proceed. The question is how many troops will remain behind, if any. The surge troops have actually been withdrawn, so they're actually at pre-surge levels, and the question that comes up now is how do you transition out in 2014? And during the election, Vice President Biden seemed to indicate that everybody was coming home, but in discussions with the Afghans, particularly ongoing, there's questions of some would be left behind to do counterterrorism or other security functions, and the numbers of those troops and what the status they would have in Afghanistan still remains undetermined.
So I take it you were struck, as I was, by the absence of any discussion during the recent presidential campaign about Afghanistan. Is it the case that neither the Republicans or the Democrats want to make any hay out of it? Everybody sort of acknowledged that it's been a tragic failure?
I think they didn't want to discuss it because they actually had no particular policies they wished to put forward. Romney had actually gotten out early during the primaries of saying we should go in and defeat the Taliban. I don't think he wanted to revisit that position. And the Obama administration, I think, was happy to let him dance around that issue because there were many questions about what the United States' role is in Afghanistan post-2014. That could have used some political debate, and I don't think they really wanted to make a decision during an election cycle.
And Thomas Barfield, as an anthropologist who's spent most of your life studying and living in Afghanistan, much of what appears to be the tragedy between the Afghans and the Americans, and it's particularly, I think, brought to light by these so-called green-on-blue assassinations of American and NATO soldiers who are killed by the Afghan soldiers at their training. And obviously there's a lot of infiltration by the Taliban, but there's also obviously tremendous cultural clashes going on here. And, I was just reading recently about a couple of American soldiers who were killed by a convoy that was passing in the opposite direction. And one of the Afghan soldiers just suddenly turned his gun on these two Americans. What is it about what's happening in Afghanistan with the Americans that you think is the source of what appears to be a kind of cultural offense that Afghans are feeling towards Americans, as though they've worn out their welcome?
the Americans probably have been there longer than the Afghans would like to see them, but then the Afghans are ambivalent, feeling that if they leave, the country might go back into civil war. So there's a tremendous amount of ambivalence about foreign forces in Afghanistan. One of the problems is by focusing on training and joint patrols. This is sort of new, and we've got troops in many cases that have only arrived in Afghanistan relatively recently, trying to interact with Afghans whose language they don't understand, whose culture they don't understand. And also, we've built up the Afghan army so quickly, it wouldn't be surprising to me that there's a lack of discipline, mentally unbalanced people, other types of things that would put this to a higher level than just Taliban infiltration. I think, you know, given where they're drawing people from, to think that you can turn people from rural Afghanistan into trained soldiers in 6 weeks, 3 months, is even military trainers would probably say that's a bit difficult to do.
Well, my understanding from the beginning of the U.S. Intervention in Afghanistan after 9/11, that many Afghans were quite relieved, and the U.S. Special forces largely, and the CIA managed to, with a very light footprint, defeat the Taliban fairly quickly. And of course, we all know that Rumsfeld and company essentially let bin Laden go, and it's all come back after 11 years in a kind of hideous way. But back then, my understanding is that there was a pretty pervasive belief amongst the Afghan people that. And I heard one quote from an Afghan that, well, the Americans put a man on the moon, they can fix this place. You know, that there was a sense that the U.S., you know, was going to be the miracle worker. Did you detect that back then? And I guess the follow-on question is, what went wrong?
Well, back then in 2002 to 2004, the Afghans did have unrealistic expectations about what was possible. But even on a realistic basis, the United States really under-delivered. But its total focus on Iraq meant that it was actually cutting the development budget for Afghanistan at the time. It really put it on the back burner. So things that could have been rather easily done in the first 3 or 4 years are now extremely difficult to do 10 years out. Because both sides, I think, are you know, frustrated with the others. What you have to realize, too, is when the Taliban were thrown out, there were only 400 Americans on the ground. In other words, they had to do things the Afghan way. They had to work through Afghan networks. They may have provided air power, money, but the Afghans did the deals and did the fighting on the ground. So there was a realization of the Americans there that they had to work through the system that was in place. Once we put an army in there, then there's a tendency for a regular army to say it should be done our way. And that's, in many countries, that could produce a good amount of friction.
Well, obviously, a lot of money's been spent, and it's difficult to know what we have to show for it. But given the history of Afghanistan, it's not clear that the country's ever been self-sustaining, at least in the modern era. What could we have done in those early days?
Well, one of the things we could have done is to focus on the infrastructure, on the economy, and particularly the rural area, not to bring Afghanistan up to the category of modern industrial state, but just sort of a functioning state. And if we had perhaps put less attention on the needs of Kabul and more on the countryside, we could have won many more friends. We probably could have done lots of things much more cheaply. Huge amounts of money was spent in Afghanistan, but the Afghans noticed that most of the money allocated to them never reached Afghanistan. So there was a tendency to pour money in, but actually not to have a whole lot in the way of results. We would build schools, but those schools would have no teachers. We would build roads, but we would build them in a very expensive way using foreign contractors that cost a lot but didn't provide Afghans jobs. So in some ways, we didn't really look at it from an Afghan perspective of how do you use the money that you've got to build stability. And we never really focused on what's Afghanistan's absorptive capacity. It's as if we put in more money, that would make things better. We never really looked at, if you've got a pint jar, you can't put a quart of water in it.
Again, I'm speaking with Thomas Barfield, who's Professor of Anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also President of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. So obviously, at this point, the United States is weary of this situation, and there's always been a kind of it's been a little hard to take, I guess, the idea that, you know, particularly after, say, the big storm that hit the East, is, you know, why are we filling potholes in Kabul and not filling potholes in Main Street USA or taking care of the victims of the superstorm Sandy? Is there a sense on your part that we could have perhaps dealt with this government that it seems to be so alien from its people? A lot of people describe the Karzai government as a kind of narco-kleptocracy. My understanding is that they've already, him and his cronies and his family have already parked an awful lot of money in Dubai, and where they have big mansions, etc. I mean, is it really as tawdry and corrupt as it appears to be on the surface?
Well, parts of it really are, particularly among members of the elite, but in terms of ordinary Afghans, and particularly looking at a new generation of Afghans, the majority of the population was born since the Russians left in 89. When you meet younger Afghans, you actually find people that are very keen to move their country forward and see their lives in Afghanistan. So what I would recommend is that we begin focusing our attention away from the people we put into power and think about a transition to people who have a long-term stake in Afghanistan. I think you'll have a much better partnership with people who see their future in Afghanistan and not in a third country.
So, Thomas Barfield, does that mean then that it's not inexorable that the Taliban will take over when U.S. and NATO withdraw, even if they do leave forces behind, which you mentioned earlier?
It will actually be quite difficult for the Taliban to take over there, in essence, because they run into internal opposition within Afghanistan. And as long as a Kabul government has an international patron, it's extremely difficult for any insurgency to actually topple a government. This will be the fourth entry of foreign troops and their withdrawals in Afghanistan's history since the 1840s. And the ironic thing is that while no government has succeeded in imposing a government on Afghanistan when they invaded it, every ruler that they've put into power upon leaving has proved remarkably successful using outside aid but without foreign troops. That requires a particular kind of leadership. But the Russians did it, the British did it, in essence, because the Afghans themselves are looking for stability and don't want to go back to civil war. So the country has had 50 years of peace before 1978. It knows how to run the place if it's not disrupted. And I think one of the questions is letting the Afghans do things more in the Afghan way, as opposed to idealistically setting out what kind of Afghanistan we think they should have.
Well, Karzai is already a lame duck, but apparently he's making political maneuvers to continue his power after his term has ended.
He's making deals to do that, but I think from an Afghan perspective, they don't think he has the capacity to hold power once the Americans are gone. That does not mean that the Taliban will replace them, but many of his own allies, members of his own coalition, are probably looking to join other coalitions they could see as more stable. In other words, I don't think he has the capacity on his own and hasn't built the infrastructure in Afghanistan to transfer the power internally the way he would like to do. And I think many of his allies recognize that, which makes it a very unstable coalition if you're thinking of trying to pass power to someone in his own family or to someone that he trusts. Because he's run that for so many years with the backing of the international community. As that backing declines, his allies will see there's less incentive to go with his coalition and they'll be looking for other options.
We're going to take a brief station break now and we'll be back continuing the conversation about the future of Afghanistan with Thomas Barfield.
This is a war we can win. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins? And
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And we are continuing the conversation here with Thomas Barfield, who is a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and the author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. So if it's not inevitable that the Taliban are going to take over, one's been reading stories recently in the New York Times, for example, about how in the area around Herat, the warlords are sort of hedging for a new civil war, and this has sort of embarrassed the Karzai government, according to this report in the New York Times, and brought into question the quality of the Afghan National Army. First of all, is it a national army, is there a possibility that it's cohesive enough to survive or even defeat a possible renewed insurgency from an emboldened Taliban?
The question would be, once the foreigners are gone, will the Taliban be able to move from sort of unconventional warfare to conventional warfare? That's a very difficult thing to do. The major thing, it is a national army, but the problem is, what is its function? And to some extent, you're looking at these militias, the one in Herat, Mazar, other places. They're hedging their bets. If the country goes into civil war, they want to have a regional base. But I don't think any of these factions want to take the country into civil war. And the Taliban, looking at this, they may be fairly powerful in parts of Afghanistan, particularly Pashtun parts of Afghanistan. But their ability to take over the whole country is problematic, which may mean that you'd be looking at an intra-Afghan deal, that they would sit down and decide how things are going to be divided up. That's traditionally how things have been done in Afghanistan. If no side thinks it's going to win, there's the possibility of coming to some kind of agreement in which you might not have quite as powerful a central government, that regions would have more autonomy. The southern part of Afghanistan might look like Taliban light, but it wouldn't be necessarily a particularly radical regime. There's all kinds of different ways of doing this, but right now we don't really know what the situation is. We don't know how many foreign troops are going to be there, and that's certainly something that concerns the Taliban. If the Americans leave behind their air power, that makes it almost impossible for the Taliban to take Kabul. They can't really get on their trucks and drive if they can be taken out from the air. And we have no indication from the American side what is our policy towards that. Even if we're not fighting an active insurgency, would the United States be available as a backstop to prevent the Taliban from moving to a more conventional style warfare?
But hasn't it always been a problem, given that Afghanistan is a landlocked country, getting the supplies in to fight a war and to maintain the presence of the U.S. and NATO troops there? We've had to rely on a very uncertain ally, Pakistan, and the Pakistanis have on a couple of occasions cut off the supply routes and have extorted the United States and NATO for extra money. So it's clear, isn't it, that the Pakistanis have a different agenda from America and NATO. So what incentive would there be on the part of Pakistan to allow the supplies to continue to come in to, say, American air power that stays behind if, as it appears to be the case, Pakistan supports the Taliban and presumably they want a Taliban victory in a post-NATO-US Afghanistan?
Yes, but they wanted the equivalent of a Taliban victory, a Mujahideen victory, when the Soviets pulled out and they were unable to get that under much more favorable conditions. The thing is, the United States has developed a northern route to supply its troops through Russia and the Central Asian states, and they have their own political reasons for wanting to see the United States maintain some kind of stability just for their own interest. So Pakistan overplayed its hands in terms of cutting the supplies by forcing the United States to develop a greater transportation and supply network through the north. Secondly, India has become to be more interested in this, and while it's not willing to commit troops right now, it has certainly shown much more interest in Afghanistan, and it has built a road from the Persian Gulf through Iran to the Afghan border. So it's by no means clear that Pakistan holds all the major cards in this game. Beyond that, the Afghans inside Afghanistan, including the Taliban, probably are not really concerned about what Pakistan wants. And Pakistan doesn't really have direct control. It has support of the Taliban, but it's not clear it can dictate to them what a political settlement will look like to the extent that it could force them to give up a deal if other Afghan factions were offering something attractive.
Well, of course, Thomas Barfield, the United States does not have any kind of relationships with Iran, except rather hostile relationship, and in the middle. And now, of course, there's extensive sanctions on Iran and even talk of war with Iran. So there's no way in the world, I mean, it would be logical for the United States to form an alliance, surely, with the Iranians, who are very concerned about a resurgent Taliban. And they almost went to war against the Taliban at one point, I recall. And you mentioned this road that the Indians have built that from the Persian Gulf all the way up to Herat, I guess. So that would make an awful lot of sense. Is there any way that the Indians could be the kind of front for an American resupply route?
Well, it wouldn't be a resupply route. In fact, the question is that would the Indians be replacing the United States as the major guarantor of stability in Afghanistan? Iran might really like to see that to have the Indians in the Americans out would be a benefit for them. And if there's any country that's more concerned about terrorism in the United States, it's India. And this brings us into some difficulties with the traditional hostility between Pakistan and India. But Kabul has always gotten along very well with Delhi and has very often been hostile to Islamabad, regardless of the government that's been there. So I'm not talking about asking that there would be a pass-through. What I'm talking about is that the Indians, while not wanting to be involved in Afghanistan, would be very concerned about a power vacuum that led to a Taliban victory, because they would see themselves potentially as victims of that, more even than the United States. So you sort of see Indian policy evolving, not wanting to get into Afghanistan, but worried about a political or military vacuum if they don't take a greater role, and they built the capacity to do it. So, you know, that's something to watch.
Well, we know, though, that Pakistanis are totally paranoid about India, and that in a way it's the justification for military rule. You know, the old joke is that Pakistan is not a country with an army, but an army with a country. And my understanding is that the ISI and the army's sort of legitimacy, since they dominate the country, is based upon fear of India. And this is just going to make them even more paranoid, isn't it, surely?
Well, it certainly will. But until recently, the United States has bought into the Pakistan side and said, we respect your interest. But as the relationship between Pakistan and the United States has deteriorated, I think the question in Washington has been, so why are we concerned about Pakistan's interest in this if they're supporting an insurgency against the Kabul government, against the American troops that are there? But even beyond that, the irony is it's not clear that Pakistan could afford to pay for an insurgency in Afghanistan if America didn't fund its army. And if America gets out and cuts its aid, would Pakistan even have the resources to support a foreign adventure in Afghanistan? India and China are growing economic powers. They can flex their muscle. But Pakistan's one of the poorest countries in the region, and, you know, to some extent has acted as a peer polity to India, seen itself as a military equal because the United States has funded those ambitions. As the United States gets out of Afghanistan, I can see even less interest in Washington as to why should we be paying Pakistan, and why should we be so concerned about Pakistan's interests if they're not at all interested in understanding where American interests lie.
Well, it is a puzzle to me, Thomas Barfield, why the Pakistanis don't see the danger of a radical Taliban regime in taking over Afghanistan, because surely that would embolden the Pakistan Taliban, who have mounted all kinds of attacks against the government. in Pakistan itself. So I don't get their agenda. Could you explain why they would want a radical regime, why they want the Taliban to take over, and in turn, wouldn't that impact what seems to be a fairly delicate balance there where the Islamists are trying to take over Pakistan itself?
I personally think it's quite dangerous because a victory in Afghanistan for radical Islamists, for the Taliban, what would be their next target? And I would see it would be, well, if we've done this, why not turn east and go after Islamabad? I would think it's a great concern, or should be a great concern, to Pakistan. But Pakistan has always had, or at least its military has always had, the belief that it could control the situation, that it would be able to dominate a Kabul government. And after 9/11, they told Mullah Omar that he should turn over Osama bin Laden, otherwise the Americans would attack Afghanistan, and Mullah Omar refused. This, you know, ruined Pakistan's foreign policy that they've been working on for 10 years, and the Taliban were supposed to be their clients. I think any lesson from Afghanistan should show that no foreign power should think that it can dictate to the Afghans what they want to happen and expect that it will. And I think Pakistan overestimates its ability to, even if it gets a Pashtun Islamist government, that radically overestimates its ability to actually control that government. But sometimes governments as well as people can live in delusions that only reality manages to crack.
Again, I'm speaking with Thomas Barfield, Professor of Anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. But from what you've told us, Thomas Barfield, the choices here, not that there are many choices for any of the players, and it doesn't seem like the people in the region are sufficiently cohesive to try and kind of mediate some sort of permanent settlement there, even though that obviously would make a lot of sense. But if what I'm getting from you is that if the United States pulls out, as they plan to do, that will weaken the Pakistan militaries, particularly in terms of being on the American gravy train. So the idea of a nuclear-powered, paranoid state that's becoming increasingly impoverished, that is not a particularly good scenario. And then the other scenario is that if a radical Taliban regime takes over in Afghanistan, with help from Pakistan, it's likely to have blowback in Pakistan itself. So either way, you're ending up with a Pakistan, a nuclear-armed Pakistan, that's going to be increasingly unstable.
Unfortunately, Pakistan seems to be becoming the North Korea of South Asia. That's another regime that uses nuclear weapons to gain a degree of international attention and military respect well beyond what its economy would demand, and is working in a world where it's economics, not military, that makes is the most important aspect of power. And I really don't see how Pakistan can maintain what it's doing if the United States decides that it's unwilling to pay for it. It doesn't have the internal resources. But as you say, this could be quite dangerous. And I think that's one of the reasons for trying to think about some kind of security in Afghanistan, not because the United States is so interested in Afghanistan, but as a hedge against problems in Pakistan. I think that's ultimately, in terms of looking at the investment, that the focus should not be on Afghanistan itself, but about trying to maintain stability in the region. And with the exception of Pakistan, all of Afghanistan's neighbors, for their own reasons, would like to see a stable Afghanistan. So I think the United States should try, not in terms of a diplomatic agreement, but in terms of self-interest of the governments involved, trying to create facts on the ground, whether they be economic development or others, that gives Afghanistan more stability because all of the neighboring countries see it as in their interest, and perhaps Pakistan, out of necessity, could be grudgingly gotten to go along with this.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Thomas Barfield.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Barfield, who is a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking further about the future of Afghanistan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer who served in Afghanistan. She's also a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me.
And clearly, Afghanistan was barely mentioned in the presidential campaign, as, for example, was global warming. But it's not going away. And, of course, the current recent scandal with the general in charge indicates, I mean, the fact that he's the 11th commander in 11 years in itself is a bit of a scandal, I think. So what's the prognosis going forward here, do you think?
Well, I think it at multiple levels, Afghanistan is a hot soup sandwich. I think as you have covered over the years, the strategy, of course, is that the Afghan National Security Forces are going to be in a position that they can take over primary security duties, while the Americans and our NATO partners really draw down our combat activities, and we revert to a much smaller footprint with troops that are there primarily to train the ANSF. You know, the ANSF, they've come a long way, but many people are skeptical that they're going to be able to manage Afghanistan's security needs without more American and NATO assistance than either America or NATO actually wants to give. And then, of course, from the point of view of the people that are going to continue in the training capacity, as you know, the so-called green-on-blue violence is really unacceptable. And so you'll hear reports of tremendous distrust between the Afghan and U.S. NATO ISAF counterparts. So on that front, I think there's a lot of disquiet. The failure of any meaningful political dialogue with the Taliban, which is now going into its nth year of failure, has raised a lot of fears in Afghanistan itself that it's going to revert back to civil war. And then, of course, thirdly, not only was there no discussion of Afghanistan in the debate, there really wasn't a meaningful discussion of Pakistan. In the absence of a robust Pakistan strategy, many people suspect that Pakistan is going to continue doing what it's always done, which is supporting Islamist proxies, and that in itself is going to increase the likelihood that Afghanistan reverts back to some kind of a civil war-like scenario. So Afghanistan does not look good, no matter from which particular angle you examine it.
Well, already there are reports from Herat that the local warlord is preparing his army for a civil war. And, of course, this has been an embarrassment to Karzai, who obviously believes that there is a national army, but most people are pretty skeptical about the real nature of the Afghan national army and whether indeed it is a national army.
No, I mean, that's true. I mean, for many years, the you know, the police, for example, would garner a lot of attention and criticism for the vast corruption, both within the police force, but then all the way up through the Ministry of Interior. For many years, people would laud the Afghan National Army as some sort of incredible institution that was somehow heads and shoulders above the others. But what we've seen in recent years is that there's quite a bit of corruption in the Ministry of Defense, that warlordism really hasn't gone away. And in fact, if you were an Afghan warlord, what incentive would you have to actually participate as a national army as opposed to a coalition of warlord militias? So, I think that's really true. And of course, you know, one of the big problems throughout the last 11 years of fighting this war in Afghanistan is that rather than trying to find some common ground with Iran, the United States has really chosen increasingly a path of standoff with Iran. And that meant that we were increasingly dependent upon Pakistan, which would have been fine if our interests were aligned with Pakistan's interests, and obviously they weren't. So, you know, we've put ourselves in this situation where we don't really have any regional allies, and we're really dependent upon that one country, Pakistan, whose interests are completely the opposite of ours. What Pakistan wants in Afghanistan is not what we want. And even though our current situation with Iran is certainly not appealing in any way, shape, or form, we still have more in common with the Iranians in terms of what kind of Afghanistan we'd like to see than we have with the Pakistanis. And so it's disappointing looking at the way in which the Americans have handled not only the domestic situation in Afghanistan, but also the regional picture as well, and the relationships with Afghans near and not so near neighbors.
Again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer who served in Afghanistan. She is a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. So given the recent downfall of General Petraeus, what's your sense of his contribution, if you will, to this situation? It seems in retrospect that the so-called surge in Afghanistan didn't achieve anything, as far as I can tell, and it just prolonged the agony between these two competing strategic visions of counterinsurgency versus counterterrorism. So what's your assessment?
I mean, so I've been in the boat that says the surge was a bad idea for years. You know, I can say that I did congressional testimony in 2009 as the Obama administration was being corralled into sending the surge and saying very clearly that it's a bad idea. It was a bad idea for a couple of reasons. One, the proponents of the surge, based upon Petraeus's infamous FM-324, Field Manual 324, which was accorded some stature in so-called pacifying Iraq. Now, historians will eventually adjudicate whether or not this switch to a so-called coin posture in Afghanistan was more important than other factors in Iraq. But what you definitely saw was that this whole industry of coinistas, and we're talking about Andrew Exum, John Nagel, David Kilcullen, obviously McChrystal, Petraeus, you know, this whole coinista industry did feel that this was a way forward in Afghanistan. Those of us who know the region were very skeptical for a number of reasons. If you actually look at the country studies upon which FM-324 was based, they were all largely post-colonial. They had functioning bureaucracies. The insurgencies tended to be urban. In other words, all of the characteristics were really not applicable to Afghanistan. And of course, even if you took those numbers, if you took FM-324 at face value and you actually took the math to have any sort of biblical, Quranic, or Talmudic truth, you really needed something on the order of 375 to 400,000 troops. So the surge made no sense in terms of its justification vis-a-vis FM-324. There were not any battlefield effects. You know, for example, when you're going to talk about a surge, you would have expected the commanders to have said, we're going to achieve these battlefield effects. To achieve these battlefield effects, we need to accomplish XYZ. To accomplish XYZ, we need to have these kinds of troops increased in these kinds of numbers and with these kinds of assets in place. None of that calculation took place. They pulled this number, 30,000, initially 40,000, out of their posteriors. And, you know, I think I have to agree with you. It's not clear what the surge has secured. You remember Operation Mosharraq in Helmand, where the U.S. media was seized. Very quickly, that operation fell out of the attention of the media because it didn't go as planned. And so I think, you know, what we've seen at the end of this surge is we've lost many more Americans. Many more Afghans have died. Obviously, our partners in NATO ISAF have also perished. And I think it's unfortunate that the reason why General Petraeus is being raked over the coals is because of who he screwed and not who he screwed over, which, quite frankly, are the Americans and the troops that we sent into harm's way. I think it's very unfortunate that the only scrutiny that he is being subjected to is over his personal life and, quite frankly, not the management of this war and a set of policy prescriptions that actually has been very injurious to our forces in Afghanistan.
So again, Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer who served in Afghanistan. She's now a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. I remember speaking with David Kilcullen, of course, he was very much General Petraeus' eyes and ears in Iraq and then served with him in Afghanistan and came up with this concept of the armed social worker. And I've never understood what we thought we were doing there in terms of nation building, which we've apparently been completely unsuccessful at, even though billions of dollars have been spent. There's precious little to show for it. So how can you do nation building in a nation that's never been able to sustain itself, at least in the modern era?
Well, you know, again, you know, as you know, I mean, we've discussed this several times over the years on this show. When the British were institution building in the Indian subcontinent, they actually did that over a series of several hundred years. So, for example, the parts of India that became North India, for example, the Delhi area and so forth, that part of India had been subjected to, you know, well over 250 years of colonial intervention. And of course, you know, the whole process that you know, I'm not defending colonialism. I'll be very, very clear. But the process by which that took place was, first you had this encounter with militarism, then you had this essentially imported bureaucracy with Brits running the show, and then they went through this process of indigenization. And by the time 1947, 48 came around, the parts that became India had largely been indigenized. And compare that to the parts that became Pakistan, they were still very much in the militarized phase of that. In fact, the Punjab had become part of the Raj only circa 1860. So it was a relatively late comer to the game. So when you ask what can be accomplished in 11 years, I mean, you put that in the context of it took the British 250 some odd years to create institutions. And those are still the institutions that India functions with today, the constitution, the courts, the relationship between the states and the central government, the provincial governments. What people thought could be accomplished in 11 years, I think, is risible. I think people made a lot of comparisons to the Balkans. You remember the RAND Corporation made a lot of hay, how we haven't put enough money into Afghanistan. I was skeptical of that argument as well. The reason being is that in the Balkans, when we did our nation-building exercise, there was actually already a substantial amount of institutionalization and human capital. There was simply not a comparable infrastructure into which those investments were made in Afghanistan. And I think, you know, over the course of time, as we can sort of sift through what happened and with what consequences, I think the argument can be made that the ways in which investments were made in Afghanistan pretty much sealed the fate of demise for Afghan institutions in the sense that more than anything, it fostered corruption. You know, you simply can't, you know, force those kinds of funds through the particular structures that were in place in Afghanistan. So, you know, I would like to see, as I said, more accountability held to the masterminds of our Afghan strategy and why they failed, why they were so certain, the promises that they made that they failed to keep. I'd like to see the criticism really be shown in those areas rather than the, you know, the various sexual peccadilloes of the men in uniform. I think that's really a sideshow. It might be symptomatic of what was going on, that these generals had become celebrities, that these generals saw that they were too important to follow the rules to which they subjected their subordinates. But ultimately, that's symptomatic. It's not causal. How is it that we had these runaway generals that were so confident that their policies would work, and yet they clearly haven't, and yet the only thing to which they're being held accountable is their sex lives? I just don't understand that.
Well, Christine Farah, I understand that, having read Rajiv Chandrasekharan's book about Afghanistan, that there's also quite a bit of blame to lay at the civilian aid people like USAID. One of the stories in his book that's extraordinary is that we've heard so much about the heroin trade and trying to eradicate it, and which that's the source of so much corruption and this kind of narco-kleptocracy that Karzai family represents, that they, you know, they could have substituted that crop, but I take it it was the cotton lobby in the United States that stopped it. I'm not sure of why.
No, I mean, that's a little bit more complicated. I mean, so essentially, there's about four-ish countries that legally produce poppy. Australia is one of them, Turkey, India, I think there's a fourth. Essentially, for Afghanistan to be allowed to grow poppy as one of these licensed legal poppy growers, this has to go through the UN. And at every point along the way, India, Turkey, and Australia rejected allowing Afghanistan to do that. And the reason being is that obviously when you flood the market, you affect the price. And so those countries that are in this cartel of legally producing poppy enjoy the situation that they have. And so everyone talks about, you know, Afghanistan to be allowed to legally export its poppy. Given the way in which that particular regime is managed, it sounds a lot easier than it actually is. The other problem, and I think the Americans learned this pretty quickly early on, is that you really can't fight the narcotics problem and an insurgency at the same time. The reason being that if you look at where the poppy is growing, it's where there's no control of the state. Where there's no control of the state, it's also where the Taliban are. So, for example, some of the most insurgency-afflicted provinces in Afghanistan is also where the poppy is most prevalent. And that's probably because both poppy and the Taliban flourish where the state does not. Now, if you're trying to cultivate local support to provide intelligence against the Taliban and the various warlords that are affiliated with them, what you probably don't want to do is knock out the single most important source of income for your informants, and that's poppy. So pretty early on, the Americans concluded that we're not going to do counter-narcotics while we're also trying to do counter-insurgency. The problem is, as you noted, that unfortunately, the Taliban, you know, in the 90s, they were largely dependent upon Pakistan for sole source funding. And so the Pakistanis could cut that funding off as they saw fit. Now the Taliban are pretty much self-financing in various degrees through international donations, through the poppy trade, through a variety of other illegal and illicit trafficking of, you know, gems, marble, wood, you know, forest timber. So they're much more self-sustained financially than they were during the 90s under the Pakistanis. So, you know, while admitting that you can't fight both of those battles at the same time, your inability to do that pretty much conceded the Taliban as much financial space to cultivate poppy as they could, and that's what they did.
Well, I was actually referring to this plan to substitute a crop and grow cotton or something else. And my understanding was that fell apart because of the lobby here against cotton imports.
Yeah, well, I can't speak to that, but no. Of course, these are not nearly as profitable products.
Sure.
And cotton and poppy, they are not completely substitutable. I mean, poppy really is, you know, there are certain conditions under which poppy grows, and there's certain conditions under which cotton grows, and there's some overlap. But the overlap is not perfect, and the profit margins. I mean, one of the advantages of poppy, if we can speak of it in those terms, is that there are multiple processes along the way, And the value added of each of those processes is much more than your value added for cotton, right? Mm-hmm. And poppy is a very manpower, person power intensive activity. So I don't think cotton was ever going to be the panacea for this. There's been some discussion of saffron substitution, for example. But again, for you to be able to do crop substitution does suggest that you've got some control over that territory. And where the Taliban have been most effective, we don't have control over that territory, right?
Sure.
And the other thing that people sometimes forget is that the Taliban are kind of, they're the local lenders as well. And these are, and farmers are sequentially in debt to the Taliban, right? The Taliban lend them money to buy the seed for the poppy, for the various things they need to get the poppy to grow, you know, fertilizers and so forth. The Taliban help go, you know, basically go to the farm gate to buy the product. And so essentially you have to imagine this huge amount of forward debt that the farmers carry that they're indebted to the Taliban. So simply substituting crops doesn't get the farmers out of this cycle of indebtedness that they have to the Taliban. And I think that's something people just don't understand.
Just in closing, Christine Fair, let's turn to Pakistan, since it's the Gordian knot here. And since the assassination attempt by the Pakistani Taliban on the young schoolgirl, Malala, who's gained international attention, there's been some evidence inside Pakistan itself, perhaps of some kind of soul-searching.
I think it's nonsense. It's risible.
Right.
I mean, we've seen this before. We can point to 5 or 6 events over the last 11 years, and people say this is going to be the turning point when Pakistan decides whether it's going to be a jihadi state or not. But very quickly, conspiracy theories began spreading in Pakistan that shifted the criticism away from the Taliban onto other agencies. So, for example, and there are several variations of this, but there is a growing suspicion that Malala was not, in fact, shot by the Taliban. And their argument goes, if the Taliban had shot her at point-blank range in the face, she should have been dead. Therefore, since she's not dead, she must have been shot by a CIA agent, an Indian intelligence agent, RAW. There's even some bizarre conspiracy about drones being involved. And these are meant to defame, this attack was meant to defame the Islamists. Because after all, if the Islamists had wanted to kill her, she would be dead. It's a little bit like the witch burning, right? You throw the witch into the water. If she drowns, she's a witch. If she survives, burn her because she's a witch. I mean, it's just really the equivalent of that. And so, I've been around Pakistan far too long to be remotely optimistic that any of these things will have the sea shift that we would expect it to have, because of, you know, the vast willingness of Pakistanis to believe bizarre conspiracies. And, you know, that's the susceptibility of Pakistanis to peculiar conspiracies is, you know, that's a whole different topic. Sometimes people look at me with some incredulity, and I point out, well, this is, you know, a country that 2 months ago thought that they had invented a car that runs on water. So, you know, the what people need to understand is that the Pakistan Intelligence Agency has a lot of sway over Pakistani media, and they can give or detract attention to particular events selectively to suit their agenda. And so I'm not optimistic. I mean, as I said, the Pakistanis somehow think that the Blackwater, for example, is a potential culprit for having shot Malala because she is not dead. I mean, what do you do with that? I mean, that speaks to a sort of public pathology that's very difficult to understand. But rest assured, this is not going to be the turning point for Pakistan. But having said that, I don't know what will be the turning point for Pakistan. I mean, they've had prime ministers assassinated. They've had a little girl shot. They've had core commanders nearly assassinated. They've had a sustained campaign against the state since 2004 on the part of proxies gone wild. I mean, you'd think that at some point someone would have concluded that running Islamist militant proxies is not the best way to run a country, but they certainly haven't come to that conclusion yet.
So do you think, though, that after the 2014 pull out of the U.S., and that's not to suggest that there are not going to be troops left behind or special forces left behind in Afghanistan, but if the U.S. were to reduce its footprint sufficiently in Pakistan that the Pakistanis wouldn't have the excuse to blame everything on the Americans, would that make any difference?
No, because they're still going to find some way. I mean, one of Pakistan's unfortunate strategies is to externalize the reasons for its varied problems and blame it upon Americans, the Israelis, the Indians, the Afghans, what have you. And, you know, this is a complicated game that the Army plays to deflect any sort of criticism or blame. And, you know, already, I mean, some of the Pakistani narratives are, you know, we're in this situation with our Pakistan Taliban because of the American war. And when the Americans leave, the Pak Talibs will go back to fighting the Indians or fighting the Afghans, and they'll stop targeting us. So for many Pakistanis, the solution to their Pakistan problem is for NATO and ISAF to go away so that the Taliban can go back to Afghanistan. And they, you know, obviously this is not going to work out as they imagine, because the Pakistan Taliban are not the Afghan Taliban. They do not want the same things. They want different things. So, you know, Pakistan is going to be in for a series of rude awakenings. But I don't, you know, it's just hard to imagine what's going to make the Pakistani state get over its jihad habit. It's just difficult to see anything that's going to be so shocking and to put such a shock to the Pakistani system that they reverse what's really been a strategy since 1947. And it has been their strategy since 1947. It's not new. So I'm not optimistic. And I'm also looking at the political process in Pakistan right now. They're also going to be gearing up for an election some point next year. And you just look what their electoral possibilities are. There's Imran Khan. He's a Taliban apologist. AQ Khan, the black market nuclear marketeer, is launching his own political party. And then, of course, you have the mainstay political parties, which have been feckless and corrupt. So, it's difficult to look around and see a Thomas Jefferson on the Pakistani horizon.
Well, on that note, I thank you so much for joining us, Christine Fair.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer who served in Afghanistan. She's a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and find answers to questions that a lot of listeners have been sending in lately. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/IanMastersMedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.